Welcome to The Ramp Up, the podcast that tells the inspiring stories of the thought leaders, founders, and experts behind the leveraged loan and structured credit markets. I'm your host and CEO of Auctora, Brian Vigile. Together, we'll uncover what it takes to ramp up a market, turn the tide, and really shake things up. How do you migrate an idea into a thriving business? Let's find out. On this episode of The Ramp Up, I'm joined by Steven Hunter, co-founder and CEO of Ninefin. In this conversation, we talk about Steven's early entrepreneurial instincts, what drew him into credit, the market inefficiencies that led to Ninefin, and what it takes to build a technology company in a market that has historically been slow to change. We also get into the role of AI in credit workflows, Ninefin's global expansion, and the leadership lessons Steven has learned while scaling the business from an idea into a global platform. Enjoy the conversation. Steven, thank you for coming on The Ramp Up. I know we've talked about this for some time, so I'm really happy that we now get to sit down and have these conversations. Welcome.
Awesome. Really happy to be here.
Let's go to Belfast. Tell us about growing up, early childhood in Belfast. I know it wasn't Belfast, it was a small
nearby.
Place outside Belfast. It was close by. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So I grew up in kind of County Armagh, a little bit south of Belfast. And both my parents were doctors, went to school there, went to school in a little place in the county next door called County Tyrone. And, you know, I wouldn't really like school. I wasn't a big school person. I did well in school, but I think I probably picked a fight with every single teacher at some point. And then younger brother, younger sister, and a dog at one point.
What's the dog's name?
Dash was his name, because he had a little dash on the top of his head. It's a cute little thing. And so living in the countryside, middle of nowhere, need to drive for 20 minutes to get to anywhere. So very much not like being in London or New York or the big city. But that was where I was born. That was where I grew up.
And I know you were very musically oriented as a kid, music theater. Talk about that and all the little side hustles you're doing.
That was an alternative career path for me, I think.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, I did speech and drama. I did lots of musical theater plays. I used to sing. So my voice broke and then I couldn't really sing as well as I used to. But
what did you sing?
Like everything in musicals. Like,
don't worry, we're going to make you sing here.
No, not that's a different podcast. So I would, all the kind of Rodgers and Hammerstein's musicals, like Oliver, and loads of musicals as a kid. I did like some pantomime stuff as well, but mostly musicals. And was like a member of like a choral society. And so I would go and do that, in the evenings, and we'd prep for a couple of months. And then we'd go and do a show in like a local theater or opera house. So that was a massive part of my childhood. And then I got to probably just going into secondary school in the UK. So I was maybe 11, 12. And there was a kind of pivotal moment where it was, okay, you could actually pursue this professionally and get an agent and go to the West End in London.
Wow.
And I'd done some auditions and got like reasonably far. And there was a decision point where it was like, okay, you can do that or you can focus on your studies.
Yeah.
And after some consultation with my parents, they decided that I should focus on my studies. and so we didn't pursue the musical theater kind of side of things, and then started to get stuck into schoolwork. And that was an interesting pivotal moment in a parallel universe somewhere. I'm either a completely broke actor on the streets or maybe successful somewhere in the West End. But that was a really important part of my childhood growing up.
I got to ask, because we were just talking about this before the show, that you went to an event recently and Ryan Reynolds was on stage.
Yep.
Do you ever wonder what it could have been if you had pursued a different alternative?
I do. I do. I think about it a lot, actually. Yeah. I think it was like a big moment to choose. And I think maybe I was in Northern Ireland in Belfast, which isn't renowned for, musical theater necessarily.
Fair enough.
I wonder if maybe I've been born in London or in New York or somewhere else, then maybe things might have been different, because that was an extra friction to do something like that. But that was a very interesting time in the early kind of part of my career. But that was a big, big passion. And today I still try to get to see as many shows as I can. It's a great way to switch off and relax.
Yeah, and New York is great for that. We don't like for musical theaters here.
Absolutely not. I mean, the only challenge is that, although I say it's relaxing to go and see them, sometimes I'll go and I'll just be watching for things that aren't meant to happen happening. And, you know, oh, that note was exactly. slightly off, or yeah. like that prop's not meant to be there, or someone was a little early on their line. So it's also a little hard to fully adjust, but maybe in another life.
My wife is a chef. And so each time we go to a restaurant, she likes to see it like, you know, like chef's table, one of those things. And she says to me, like, you know, when I'm looking around in the kitchen, I'm like, oh, yeah, that range hood is $250,000. That's, you know, so she's like, that's how she sees experiences restaurants in terms of, you know, from that perspective. So how do you get to Bristol?
So I did a very bizarre mix of subjects in school for A-levels, which you'd specialize a little earlier in the UK. So I did history, French, maths, IT, very weird split of kind of arts and sciences. And I always wanted to kind of work in the city. I like current affairs. I think like a kind of part of my teenage life was the 2008 banking crisis. It was always in the news and I'm like, oh, what is this kind of what's happening in the city? And when I was picking my subjects, I was, you know, do I want to do maths at university? Do I want to do, you know, something financial like economics? But I settled on doing law and I went to all the universities. And I really like Bristol. And it's close to London, but it's also not a crazy big city. And I thought, well, if I'm going to work in London at some point anyway, then you probably don't want to go to university or college there, get something, experience something different. So really nice city. It was a good law school. And you can do law undergrad in the UK. You don't have
what
to do postgrad.
What year did you get into Bristol?
So that was 2010 was when I started it at Bristol. Three-year course. I loved it. Amazing city. And I was, you know, very involved in all of the various different societies because kind of had a view on like the financial world as well. And I didn't do law because I necessarily wanted to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
It was more, keeps your options open. It's a well-respected like academic subject and some legal skills could be useful. So, and I always liked negotiating with people and debating in school and things like that. So it felt like a good natural course.
I didn't do law. I was an economics and computer science major, but I did my first year, also did A-levels, by the way, mm-hmm. in Zimbabwe. And my first year at the University of Zimbabwe, I took a law class. And I was amazed at the amount of Latin that you mm-hmm. gotta, you know, cram and remember and all those things. But it was fascinating. So I was like, oh, okay, maybe in an alternative world, maybe I could have gone there. Yeah. So you graduate Bristol with a law degree, then what?
So I had done a lot of internships when I was at university. And very reasonably early on in my law degree, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I therefore started like leaning into more of the finance societies, investment societies, because I think the scary thing in that industry is it's so competitive and you have to start quite early if you want to get an internship because the internship's the path to get a job. And so I was on the finance society, applied for loads of internships, did lots of extracurricular activities, and then did a summer internship with JP Morgan. And I actually don't think JP Morgan even go to Bristol anymore, but when they came to the kind of open day and they had their little stall and they had, you know, they had a stall for M&A and they had a stall for equity markets and they had the kind of debt and LevFin folks. And I got speaking to the LevFin folks and I thought this kind of sounds interesting. It doesn't have, you know, the kind of soul destroying nature of M&A and that you spend 2 years working on something that doesn't actually materialize. And it also isn't quite as, you know, fast paced as like pure DCM or ECM where deals are happening kind of every second of the day. You don't really get time to understand or know the company. So it felt like a nice middle ground. I liked the team and I took myself very seriously. So I went to the open day in a suit. There weren't very many other students there in a suit, but I was in a suit. I printed out my own little business cards. And so I gave it to the team. And I still remember one of the guys who hired me from JP Morgan, but I followed up afterwards and said, I'm going to apply for the internship, you know? And that was ultimately how I ended up working at JP Morgan was I followed up with that particular banker when I was in London or doing an interview for an internship for another bank. And I said, hey, I'm in London. Do you want to grab coffee? And he said, sure. When? I was like, how about now? I'm outside your office.
Wow.
Let's do it. And yeah. He said, oh, okay. Yeah. And it happened to work. And so we wandered around and then eventually got the internship and then got placed in the LevFin team as well, because that's where I said I wanted to go. Enjoyed that. And then off the back of that, got a full-time offer and went back to JP Morgan to start proper. So that's how I ended up in the city.
There's a theme in your early career life and even before of hustle. Mm. Do you always know that this was something that you are very good at?
I think it's a competitive world out there.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it comes from upbringing or whatever, but, you know, we always wanted to try and push ourselves and do the best that we could and know that you can't take things for granted.
Yeah.
There are 100 other applicants for every job and every internship. And, you know, the experience that people have is kind of crazy and the amazing grades and all these extracurriculars. So I think I always have had like a competitive spirit. The problem is with, you know, sports, I was always very average. So it's not good to be very competitive and very average at everything. But when it came to like applying for jobs and things like that, I felt like you needed to really hustle.
Yeah.
Speak to people, meet people, do events, build your resume, etc. So yeah, I've always had, you know, side gigs and side hustles, and even through school and even university as well.
Let's talk about those early years in leverage finance.
So it was a very interesting time in markets then, but we were very busy. And the good fortune, I guess it's mixed blessings, but the good fortune of being in a bank like JP Morgan is they tend to lead a lot of the transactions. So you get a lot of experience very fast, but it also means you work very hard and very long hours. So I did a lot of deals, worked, you know, across all different types of industries, countries. I somehow ended up doing a lot of French deals.
Hmm.
I did French for A-level, but wasn't business fluent, so.
Yeah. Did you have to travel a lot to France?
I was back and forth to Paris a good amount. I spent a lot of time in the kind of, what they used to do, they have the kind of print rooms where they would finalize the prospectus before the deal gets announced. And yeah. So you're in these rooms. So I was in it. So it wasn't that I was out exploring the city, but I mean, JP Morgan is a very nice office in Place Vendôme in Paris, which is lovely. So I did a little bit of travel, but generalist, early part of my career, got to experience, you know, a couple of deals that became IPOs, got to experience some M&A transactions. That was really fast learning curve at the start of your career, but also very intense.
Yeah, I can imagine. I did a slightly brief stint in leverage finance in my career, and I definitely distinctly remember the long nights at the printers, local printers for pitch books, external printers for the preliminary OMs. So yeah, definitely a lot in common to talk about on that score. Okay, how long were you left in banking?
I was there for 2 years. So after 2 years, I think the turnover in these teams is very high.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of calls from recruiters, and you know that, you know, often what they kind of say is like, would you like to work the CMRs and make twice as much money? Or would you like, you know, to make the same money and work half as much hours? And, you know, you were doing 80, 90, 100 hour weeks. And so I thought, I'm not sure I want to like keep working at this kind of level of intensity. And I also felt like I wanted to be a little closer to the investment decision-making process. I think early in my career, whenever I was thinking about the legal side of things, you know, the lawyers are kind of drafting up what the principals have agreed. So they're a little further removed from the transaction. And then when you get to the banking side, you're a little closer again to the kind of commercials of the deal. But I really like the investment decision-making piece of let's go actually sit and decide whether we want to invest in a particular deal or not. So I left JP Morgan and went to a credit fund. Back then it was called Babson, now it's called Barings. And I was a analyst there. And in my first week, I think they said to me, you know, what sector are you going to cover? And I was like, I'm a generalist from JP Morgan. I'll pick up whatever sector. And so I covered kind of, you know, oil and gas and industrials. And in my first few weeks.
This is what, 2014 or 15?
This would have been 2015, I think. 2014, 15, something like that.
Because 15 was an incredible year for oil and gas.
Yeah. I think in my first week, we had oil and gas drop from $75 to 30 something bucks.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the names that I was covering became distressed credits very quickly. And so I also got exposure to, you know, what happens when you're in markets, when things kind of start to look or go south. So I had to get up to speed, learn about those companies.
After the great financial crisis, I think there were two big shocks. One was Japan, but that was very brief, the earthquake in Fukushima. And then obviously the next one was oil and gas, which was a huge catastrophe for CLOs.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like being on that side? You know, and for you, you know, you're in a new job, you're in a new situation, and then all of a sudden you have this massive sector upheaval in your lap.
It was a little intimidating because, I mean, the European oil and gas space in our part of the market isn't that big. A lot of it's kind of US oriented, but it wasn't a sector I was as familiar with. But so I had to very quickly get up to speed and learn, you know, about day rates and rigs and how that, the different, you know, break evens on various, depending on where the price of oil is in terms of production. So that was quite interesting, quite intellectually stimulating. But also, you know, I remember being told in the early part of my career there, you know, and Barings is not a hedge fund shop. They're classic, traditional credit, get a good, stable return, don't lose the money. And I got told in my first couple of days, you know, don't bring something to our investment committee unless you'd put all your mom and dad's pension in it and you'd put all your own money in it, because wow, that's literally what we're doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, credit first, and then we can think about where it might price. Are you going to get the money back? Can they pay the interest? And so that kind of philosophy, whenever you have bonds that are dropping 15, 20, 30 points on the back of an oil price move, can be quite scary because you've got hundreds of millions of dollars invested. Yeah. So it felt like a lot of responsibility, but there was a great team. There were people around me who helped me with the credits who we tag teamed a lot of them together, and ultimately, you know, performed absolutely fine. But yeah, it was an interesting moment if you had oil and gas exposure.
So you are at a new spot. Oil and gas is, you know, having this moment. There's also Brexit around the corner. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you were starting to think about what this all meant for you.
Yeah.
What did it all mean for you?
So I'd always thought about starting my own company and had always been, I guess, a little, like you said, side hustle, entrepreneurial. Did various things as I was growing up and in university. And so I was kind of experiencing in my day-to-day, both at JP Morgan and at Barings in debt markets, some really old school kind of tooling and systems, very poor quality data. A lot of the companies are private. It's really hard to get the information that you need. Everything was very manual.
Yeah.
Lots of manual workflows. And you had to go to 20 different places to get the information that you needed. And, you know, there were a whole host of other problems, some of which you folks are addressing, but there are a whole host of other problems within debt markets. And it's not this kind of space that's intuitive or easy for people to understand who aren't from the industry. You know, everyone kind of knows what the stock market's like. They see, you know, the FTSE's up or the S&P's up, and they understand that a little bit more. But debt markets are ultimately how the world economy works.
Mm-hmm.
Companies borrow to buy other businesses, to scale their own, to invest. And the kind of way it operates in practice has kind of been built in the 70s and 80s and hasn't really changed that much since. And so in the early part of my career, I was thinking, you know, I want to kind of start a company someday, but I don't have the idea. And when I was working and I saw all of these different problems within debt markets, I thought, I think this can be done better.
Mm.
And I complained about everything. And the people who listen to your complaints when you're in work tend to be your family, your friends, those around you. And so for me, my flatmate and my friend from University of Bristol, Huss, he lived with me in London, and he bore the brunt of most of my complaints for a few years and not seeing me very often because I was working hard. And so the kind of things I was experiencing in my day-to-day life became the kernel of an idea for what ultimately became Ninefin.
And I know there's a very interesting story about the name of the company. Tell us about that.
So we were thinking about starting the company, and I spoke to my co-founder, Huss, and said, I think we can build a very big business solving problems in the space with technology.
Yeah.
Let's go do it. And so you mentioned the kind of Brexit vote. We were meant to resign the kind of week after the Brexit vote had happened. And so when it happened, we thought, oh, wow, it's pretty choppy out there. Is this the right time to be quitting your job?
I'm guessing that's not what you expected was going to happen.
It was, well, I mean, I don't think it was it was quite unexpected. And so we thought, you know, is this really the right time, the right moment to make a leap and do something? And so my parents have like very different, my dad is very risk on, my mom's more conservative and risk averse. And my dad was kind of like, you know, go and do it, son, go and start your own thing. And my mom was like, what are you doing? Leaving an amazing job in the middle of all this economic volatility.
Yeah.
So that was a very interesting moment to think about starting a company. But anyway, when we were starting we eventually did leave and had conviction to go and do it. And when we were starting the company, we knew it was going to be technology and data and debt markets. And we thought, well, what do we call the business? And if you look at a lot of the other businesses in our space, you know, they basically describe what they do.
Yeah.
They're kind of a restructuring or a reorg place or a leverage commentary or finance, etc. And I said to my co-founder, Huss, I think I have a website that might work for this. Because one of the side hustles I used to do was to buy websites in the hope that, you know, someone would someday come hunting for the domain and you'd make some money out of it. And so I have a whole collection of like esoteric websites that I owned, and I bought ninefin.com. And I bought it because it was four characters and a .com, which is very unusual. There aren't many left. And it had fin in it for finance. And I thought, this might be useful someday.
Yeah.
And so I said to Haas, okay, 9 fin. So fin for finance, that's obvious. How do we figure out the 9 to make this work? And the industry and the old team that I was in was leverage finance. And leverage has 9 letters in it.
Yeah.
And so that's the origins of how we got 9 fin, but also it's short, it's snappy, it's a brand. So if we expand beyond the world of credit or if we needed to pivot, we weren't kind of typecast or stuck. And also, you know, banks are always very fixated on being, you know, lead left or being, you know, first on their prospectus. And one of the things that they sometimes have to negotiate about is, well, we'll do it alphabetically, you know, so that we don't fight about it.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about having a number at the start of your name is that you come top of all the lists.
Yes.
And also from like when you search us on Google, there isn't anything else apart from radiators that have 9 little fins on them. So it was a good brand.
So every other day I get a phone call here. Somebody has bought some Octora version, you know, that they're selling to us. So in that spirit, I bought 8 fin.
Oh, no.
I'm kidding. Oh, I couldn't
resist. Then we're in trouble. As soon as someone gets an earlier number, then we're in real trouble. So.
Exactly. But it's a fantastic name. I just love that story because it says so much about you and how all those things that are part of your life come together.
Mm.
Okay, so 9 fin is born. You guys are operating out of what, your flat at the time?
Yeah. So we were in Southeast London in Greenwich, and it was the same flat that we'd moved into together when we were starting our careers. So Haas worked at Deutsche Bank, I worked at JP Morgan. He was a year older, so was at Deutsche. And then whenever I was coming to the city, he said, hey, do you want to move in with us?
Yeah.
And so we went and got a flat together. And I mean, another example of kind of side hustle things that Haas and I did. You know, when we were searching for that flat where we ultimately kind of started the company, in London, you have this crazy difference between the 2-bed market and a 3-bed market. Mm. And when you look for a 3-bed flat, you have always usually 2 quite large rooms and then 1 tiny one.
Oh, yeah.
And so that we had a lot of discussion between the two of us and our other flat. Who gets the small room?
Yeah.
And so what Haas and I worked on as a bit of a side project, which obviously wasn't never going to be a business idea. Yeah. But we started to think about how you can build a formula to determine who gets the small room and how much rent they should pay, like adjust the rent for the size of the room.
I'm very interested because I had the same problem with my roommate when we first got a flat in New York. What was the formula? How did it work?
So, I mean, we started off and just put the square footage in. But when you put the square footage in and you divide it by, or you divide the rent by the square footage, you get numbers that feel intuitively like silly because it's such a big difference between them. And so we thought about it a little bit. And we realized that if you're in a really tiny room, that extra square foot or square meter counts for a lot more than if you're in a very large room and you get an extra square foot or square meter. So it's actually not a linear relationship. It's like a logarithmic relationship. Yeah. And so you can plot that.
Mm.
And so we plotted a curve and then used that to kind of calculate the rents. And you got much more like intuitively sensible prices out of it. And then it became a little bit silly because we started tweaking it for, well, what if you have a partner living with you? Like, how are you going to adjust the electricity bills? Like, what if you have an ensuite and you have like a bathroom beside you? Or like, and so it became this whole kind of convoluted thing of, you know, who gets the smallroom.com type thing. And then, of course...
Do you still have it?
We still have the code for it. We didn't ever commercialize it, but we actually built Haas built it and we worked on it together. But then, of course, the actual place that we moved into, the rooms ended up being about the same size. So we didn't actually need to use it. We all ended up paying the same rent.
Incredible. Look, I was a trader. So the way that I did it is only how traders know how to do it. I told my roommate, we're going to bid for the bigger room. And you write a number down, you know, blindly, and then whoever bids the highest wins. So we did a B-week for
bids won it in competition for the small room. I love it. I love it. So yes, that was the flat where we were in the early part of my career. And then when we quit our jobs, we were still there and started the company. And so I remember being in our kitchen, working in the original database schema together. We were sitting coding. It was really, really amazing times, but it was also quite tough because we'd gone from being in finance and, you know, having a really good salary and a very comfortable lifestyle to, you know, we saved what we could from our finance days because we knew we were going to start the company.
Yeah.
But then we basically went to zero salary, zero income for 2 years and lived off what little savings we had and put the rest into the company.
Wow.
And so, you know, I went back to kind of being a student for those years of living on like pasta and toast and trying to build and hustle the product into existence. So it was a very, very exciting moment, but also, you know, quite scary.
I can imagine. Take us to now the first sale. I know you did a lot of trials and, you know, let's talk about up to the time that you actually, you got a customer to buy.
Sure. So we built quite a lot, and we had a very lean team. So mm-hmm. we didn't take a salary, and we raised some early stage funding. Basically, there only really was one or two early stage venture investors in Europe at the time. So we raised money from Seedcamp. And back then, they invested kind of 50,000 to 75,000 euros mm-hmm. for 5 to 7% in the company, something like that. I mean, for context today, you know, nearly 10 years later, you can raise $500,000 or $1 million for similar levels of dilution. So it was a very different market. Wow. And with that amount of capital, it's very hard to hire a lot of people to build a product. So we hired one engineer, mm-hmm. a couple of interns, and worked on building the product together. I can code, so not very well, but I could code. Haas understood the finance side of things as well. So we worked on the product, got some initial users, got a little bit of traction, raised some more funding to help us grow the team a little bit. But, you know, it took probably 2 years, I think, before we got our proper customer. We used to actually ask people to, we asked them to pay for a trial, which in hindsight was a very stupid idea, because it just introduces friction to getting feedback on your product. But so our first revenue technically was, we did have some people who paid for trials, like a couple $100 a month.
That's incredible.
But you know, that wasn't a great idea. And so our first kind of customer, I still remember it. We were in a terrible office, the one I was speaking about with you before the pod. And the customer called us and we said, look, you know, we're going to have to cut off your trial access. Your trial's come to an end. And you've got three different options to buy the product. You've got the kind of the basic version.
Yeah.
You've got the pro version. You've got the premium version. You know, in our head, we were thinking about, you know, no banker wants to buy something that's basic.
Yep.
Of course, they want to buy the premium version, right? You know, you want the best one. And we also, you know, we didn't really have a lot of the technical capability to restrict a lot of the product in the way we had in the packaging. It was just a way to get people to talk about something that wasn't purely price. Yeah. And so the first client called us and said, the product's great. We want to use it. And we'll take the top package. And they didn't negotiate on price. They didn't negotiate on terms.
Wow.
And so we were celebrating like crazy in the office. But then I reflected and thought, wow, we must have left quite a lot of money on the table that they didn't even negotiate. They just took the top package.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we said, oh, no, now we need to put together some T's and C's. We don't even have any proper T's and C's to send them an invoice or a proper contract. So that was early revenue. That was a fund.
Yeah.
Still a big client for us today who kind of took a chance on us. And then we added a couple of additional clients after that. And then it kind of snowballed over time.
So how long was it before you knew, okay, I think this thing's going to make it?
That's a really difficult question. Because I think you have to have a real sense of conviction in what you're building in mm-hmm. the early stages. And in a way, one of the biggest drivers is to prove people wrong who said it won't work.
Yeah.
And in the early days, people were kind of like, oh, Stephen's 24. He's like quit his job and going to start this like random debt thing.
And you still have the baby face. So I'm
not anymore. Not anymore.
Not anymore.
We were looking back at some videos the other day of Hassan and I, and we're like, wow, this is really taking its toll, this business. But, you know, baby face, many fewer gray hairs. But yeah, so, we always had conviction.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, do we have the capital? Can we build the product quickly enough before we run out of money? And there were some crazy times in the early days, and you kind of have to protect your employees from it a little bit, and you wear a lot of the stress yourself of, you know, we had two or three clients and, you know, less than 6 months runway, and we were out fundraising, and we'd literally diarize the day when we'd have to let everybody go.
Yeah.
If we didn't get the fundraise closed in time. And it was down to like the last 2 or 3 weeks before the company would be completely out of
funding. But you can't show that to anybody.
We couldn't show that to anyone. Yeah. But Hassan and I had kind of said, well, like, this is D-Day. This is whenever we have to shut everything down. And we had some clients then. And we thought, you know, we've put, at this stage, several years of our life into this.
Yeah.
And we've trusted these people to come along with us as a client perspective, etc. So there's some really dark, difficult moments that a lot of people don't see. But probably when we went through the COVID period.
Yeah.
You know, before COVID, the company was 10 people
mm-hmm.
and, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of revenue back then. But we actually closed some really big deals during COVID because the value and timeliness of the data and the information in those volatile markets was actually worth even more. And so we closed some big trading desks and helping people understand how COVID. And so that's when I thought, you know, there's something here. Yeah. If we can survive and have people paying us revenue during a global pandemic, then the business is here to stay.
And let's drill into that, because the pandemic was a seminal moment for, I would say, every business, right? You know, you either found your calling or you just didn't make it. What made the product compelling? What made it obvious to people during the pandemic?
So a couple of things. I think the product velocity of our company is pretty unmatched. We deliver and ship things very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little harder now, we're a bit bigger, but you know, whenever a client mentioned on a call, oh, it would be really good if you had the XYZ feature, we'd build it in a couple of days.
Wow.
So they would see it during the course of their trial. And one of the advantages for us of that was whenever COVID started to happen, we did a piece in January 2020, before it was even called COVID.
Yeah.
And we'd actually noticed some of the press in China. And so we went and looked in our data for all the companies who mentioned Wuhan, or any companies who had supply chain exposure there, or anyone who'd previously mentioned things like SARS or respiratory illnesses, to tell people, hey, here's companies that might be impacted if this becomes a bigger deal. And, you know, it very quickly did become a bigger deal. And a lot of the companies that we flagged got into serious difficulties. And so timeliness of the information, and then the fact that we were able to, you know, our roadmap was building various different things. And whenever it became clear, you know, we're going to have a pandemic, like, forget the roadmap. All that matters now is helping clients to understand what's happening with the pandemic and with COVID, where are the cases, how is it impacting companies, who should. So we pivoted the whole product roadmap and built a whole suite of tools, which thankfully now we've all retired, but focused on COVID. And you know, no one else could really move that fast or react that fast. And so that was a very powerful moment for us from a product perspective.
I think that's an incredible thing also about successful entrepreneurs, that have situational awareness to recognize the moment and what the moment requires, which may not necessarily be to a point, right? Like, you know, you've retired those things, but at the moment, that was exactly what you needed to do.
100%. And even from a, I think it was an interesting time also to have a credit background, because I think having studied law and then having worked in credit, you know, typically that's associated with risk aversion and loss prevention, not with equity story and how do you build and grow something fast. So that was quite a difficult pivot for me to starting a company that needed to be venture backed and to tell, you know, the equity story and the growth story rather than be conservative. But actually in those moments, and it's happened since when you had things like SVB or, you know, you have Russia, Ukraine. I remember we were doing the business plan for the year and we were at like quite in a, I first presented the plan to the board in early 2020. And the investors said, this is a little conservative. We think you can be a bit more aggressive.
Yeah.
You've got traction. You can, I was, okay, cool. I'll go away. I'll recut the plan. We'll come back. So recut the plan. And as I was starting to recut it, all the COVID stuff started to unfold. And the conversations very quickly became, oh my God, when do you folks run out of cash?
Yeah.
If all your customers cancel, when's the business dead?
Yeah.
I said, look, our business is great. We've got big institutions as our clients. We've got long-term contracts. They pay us in advance.
Yeah.
We're well-funded. And I said, also, I used to work in credit markets. We're good in a crisis.
Yeah.
And here's the cash flow plan. Here's the downside if everyone cancels.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how we'd manage burn. Like, we just raised capital before that. It's under control. And they're like, okay. And then ultimately what happened, as you know, Fed stepped in and the market came back, we ended up basically executing on the original plan that I had for that year. So a very interesting moment in terms of seeing a market opportunity, but also managing the company and then managing the relationship with investors and board in a volatile time.
And talk about your transition personally from lawyer. We're talking about lawyers just before we walked into here. You know, lawyers, investor, I would say conservative background, to now CEO of a VC bank. That's a different shift you got to make there.
Talk
about that.
So I think lawyers are petrified of getting sued and the downside case. And then I remember when we used to draft the offering documents, in particular the roadshow presentations for a bond deal, a securities deal, and you used to argue with the lawyers all the time about what exact words you're using on the slide. And is that exact sentence in the prospectus?
Yeah.
Because if it's not in the prospectus, we don't want you to use it in the presentation. You know, and we would say things like, in the presentations that we would put together, you know, company XYZ, the leading player in this industry. And they'd say, you can't say the leading player, you have to say a leading player.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, maybe that's a material misstatement and maybe you might get sued for it. So that was the context of where I came from in banking, you know, not wanting to get sued over securities laws. And then going to the equity world, and the first version of our presentation for our company to venture, I sent it to my co-founder, Huss, and it came back with a ton of red pen on it. And he said, you got way too many caveats in here, subject to this, or if this and this happens, we might. And he said, you know, we have to make the shift to like a sense of inevitability of when it happens, not if it happens. And, you know, we're not raising a debt prospectus here. We're not, you know, or raising a debt deal. And, you know, we have, and I think that actually probably hurt us in the early part of our company, that when we presented something to venture and the investors, the deck was actually what we could already do.
Yes.
And everyone else was pitching what they might be able to do in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
And as a result, whatever you pitch, early stage investors, I think, tend to discount it and think, well, maybe they'll get to that. But so I had to evolve the style of storytelling to be a little bit more equity story, a little bit more visionary, where the company can go, and over time make that evolution.
It's incredible. And I'm sure that's one reason why you guys have been so successful, because you do execute on those things, right? You still have a good baseline. And I think I suffer the same fate coming from the credit markets, which you're right. We tend to be a little bit more conservative, right? People plot the downside first before they think about the upside. So now we're coming out of COVID, the product is wildly successful. It's working. What does the company look like coming out of the pandemic?
So beforehand, we were maybe 10 people, and then we scaled quite quickly, and we raised more capital in summer of 2021, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think before that, all of the fundraisers had been very hard, very difficult to raise capital, either just an idea or some early traction. And 2021 was more boom times.
Yeah.
In equity funding and in markets, because the Fed had stepped in very aggressively. And so that was a great moment for us to go and fundraise. And so we had tons of interest, loads of different term sheets, 6 or 7 different term sheets from investors who could see the traction, could see the logos that we'd close, which was amazing for our stage of company, the big banks, big law firms, big asset managers. And so it was very clear we just needed more capital to grow the team more aggressively and scale the business more quickly, build more features, build out sales and marketing. And so we raised capital 2021, I think it was $8 million we raised, something like that, and used that to scale the business much, much more quickly. So I don't know how many people we would have been then, but maybe 50 people, something like that. And that was a key inflection point to get that additional capital in the door.
And you and I met, I think it was 22 or 23. Mm-hmm. And this is when now you were, I think you just moved to the US.
Yeah.
Talk about that global expansion. How did you think about crossing the pond?
So I think the US capital markets are the biggest, most liquid, most sophisticated in the world. And for our type of a company, it was just really obvious that you needed to have a big US presence and US product offering. And the customers were pulling us there. They were saying, okay, what you folks do in Europe is great.
Yeah.
But when can you service my US team as well? So we needed to go to the US. The question was when. I wanted to go quite early on, but the US is an expensive place. And if you raise $5, $6, $7 million, you basically can't really do a proper expansion into the US. So we raised a bigger round in 22. And we didn't necessarily need the capital at that point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the business was growing really fast. And I thought, you know, 6 months from now, we'll be able to raise it at a much bigger valuation. But there was a good moment. We met a really good partner in Spark who invested in us to go to the US. And when I spoke to other founders who had built global businesses, I said to them, you know, we're thinking about US expansion. I think a lot of European companies don't do this very well. How can I make sure I do it well?
Yeah.
And what they said was, you know, how much of your revenue do you think will come from the US in the next 5 years? I said, probably 70%.
Hmm.
And they said, founder's got to go.
Yeah.
Founder's got to go. And so Hassan and I spoke about it, and I said, you know, I have no wife, no kids, no mortgage.
Yeah.
I've been in the US before. It's a 5-6 hour flight. I'll go. And maybe at some point we switch, but I'll go. And so I moved to the US with no team, no product, no people, nothing, not even an office, and mission, build a business in the US, scale the data, scale the team, or get the data working, the product working, scale the team, get people to know who on earth we are over here in the US market and leverage what we have in Europe. So that was a big moment, going from very European-centric and headquartered business to US is the top priority of scaling.
I know your point, you've been here before, but now you moved here.
Mm.
What was the biggest shock for you?
The prices, it's really expensive.
You moved to New York.
Because the thing that shocked me was really the post-COVID inflation.
Yeah.
Because when I used to come to New York in the early days of my career, New York felt expensive to me in the same way that London was expensive.
Yeah.
They weren't miles apart. Maybe the, you know, some things were more expensive in London, some things were more expensive in New York, but it didn't feel like sticker shock so much when you got here.
Yeah.
And I remember when I came here and I, you know, I think I was looking for an apartment to rent at the time, which is also very difficult when you come to the US as having no US credit history or background. And I think my flat in London was probably something like a little over $1,000 a month.
Wow.
And it was a good deal, but, you know, and I was sharing with other people, but I came here and I was like, oh, you know, I'll try and find a one bed in Manhattan. And they're like, oh, it'll be $5,000 a month. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like that's yeah. crazy.
Yeah.
So that and the cost of living and then also how expensive it was to hire people here.
Yeah.
Was a big shock. Obviously we planned for it before we came, but that was probably one of the really big surprises.
And that time, post-COVID, it was a tough hiring market because the labor market was so hot and a lot of people had moved out of the city, so.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, we were lucky in a way that we had engineering and product mostly in London, but even in London, that market then was very hot. I mean, I remember we had people at other companies on the engineering and software side were getting 3 or 4 pay rises in the space of 6 months.
Yeah.
The market was moving so fast and was so hot. And my co-founder would come to me and say, oh, we've got to change salaries again. I was like, we only just changed them. This is madness. Yeah. We can't keep up with this level of inflation. Like, it won't work. So we kind of held a line on that. And then obviously there were a lot of layoffs by other companies afterwards who'd overhired, overextend themselves whenever the market became a bit more rational again. But yeah, it was a very interesting time in markets,
mm-hmm.
which is cool for us covering it, but also from a founder perspective of trying to manage your cost base and your hiring speed.
You guys have always been talking about AI before AI was really sexy. Talk about that a little bit, about exactly how you guys decided to embrace this much more before everybody else caught on.
Yeah. So I think when we started the company, we had a very strong conviction that we wanted to be a technology company.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it comes from my co-founder, Huss, where I think in a lot of the big institutions, people kind of see tech and engineering as the people who come and switch on the computer for you and set it up. And if you have a bug or a problem, they fix it.
Yeah.
And it's not seen as being on a kind of par with the front office.
Yeah.
And, you know, we also grew up when the kind of the Googles and Amazons of the world started to grow very fast. And so for us, it was, well, we need to be a technology-driven business because technology is the best way to solve some of these problems rather than throwing people at them. And also, being lean and not having much money in the early days, I mean, you can't hire 10 people to extract the financials for a company, even if you do it offshore, you can't do it. And also, our original product was around financial data, getting financials out of PDF documents. And the problem with extracting a lot of that data by hand or manually, it was very slow, it's very expensive, and it's quite inaccurate.
Yeah.
And you don't have an audit trail of where it came from. So what we built in the early day, mostly out of necessity for the volume of data we had to process, was a combination of computer vision that would read a financial table in a PDF the same as a human eye would, plus machine learning to classify the different financial statements and map them together. And then also a little bit of neural nets, which back then, machine learning, that was AI.
Yes.
And so our original tagline for the company was like AI-powered financial data for bond markets.
Yeah.
And over time, that's obviously evolved. And then, you know, now, that was before AI was kind of seen as being cool. That was back when it was, oh, crypto, and everyone wants to do an ICO. And then you had the kind of remote, you know, when Zoom stock went through the roof, etc., all these various different periods. But now, of course, you know, when people say AI, they don't really mean AI, they mean LLMs. And that's the latest and greatest AI technology. But for us, our ethos was technology company, and let's use the best technology to solve the client's problem. We're not ideological that it must be an LLM or it must be computer vision or it must be XYZ. It was like, what's the best way to solve the client's problem using technology? So, and you know, today we use LLMs across the whole suite of the product internally, client facing, to extract the data, to help people surface it. So it's a very, very powerful technology. But I think what people, and I think this is a step change moment in the market in terms of how the world works, but there will also be new AI technologies in the next 5 to 10 years, when maybe people will forget about LLMs and they'll say there'll be something latest and greatest that's even better.
Yeah, you're right. And we went through the same thing as well. Like our first application of AI 10, 15 years ago was the machine learning models, the neural nets. And then I remember we were also, our seller said at the time, we were leaning heavily on doc extraction. And for us, the biggest challenge was actually you could extract the text, but the tables were one of the biggest challenges. And we're going, you know, hell on fire trying to figure out how do you extract a table. But I'm sure you guys cracked that as well.
It was difficult. And table extraction was, we actually thought at one point, should we pivot the whole company into being like table extraction as a service?
Wow.
Because it was so good at the time. Yeah. It was better than what Google did. It was better than what anyone else did. But we wisely, in hindsight, made the decision that that type of data extraction would probably get commoditized.
Yeah.
And so we'd rather own the analysis, the data, the workflows, than just the kind of pure extraction piece. So we didn't do that, but we did a lot of data extraction. I think the challenge in our market for data extraction, I'm sure you folks experienced this too, even though you have lawyers crawling over all the documents, they often have mistakes.
Yeah.
Even in the financial reporting, in the early days, we built really good technology to extract the information, and it extracted it exactly as it was on the page. But then you would sum up the balance sheet and it wouldn't sum.
Yeah.
And so we'd email the CFO of the company and say, like, by the way, your balance sheet doesn't sum that you reported to your securities investors. Why? And they say, oh, I had that row hidden in Excel. And so it didn't pull through. Like, we left off the current derivative liabilities line item. So even if you had like the best technology, you had edge cases like this that you needed a human to step in and intervene. I remember we had one of the probably most embarrassing ones. I won't say which bank it was, but we used technology to extract all the bookrunners who were on the front cover of the prospectuses. And on one of the deals, we missed one of the bookrunners, and I couldn't understand why it hadn't been picked up. And it was because one of the banks had actually misspelled their name on the front cover of their prospectus. And I thought, oh, there's some poor analyst who's going to be in real trouble for that. But a combination of technology and people is very important, I think.
So, Stephen, what does the company look like today?
So today we're a global player. So we have offices in London, Belfast, back home. I opened an office. We also have a big presence in New York. And then we most recently expanded into Latin America and also into Asia. So part of our thesis for the company, obviously we're ambitious and want to build a global business. And US and Europe are probably the biggest markets.
Yeah.
But increasingly, it's a global world. And also Asia is going to be the growth markets of the future. Also, Latin America is extremely interesting from kind of a distressed debt perspective as well. Lots of interesting things going on there for our clients. And our clients are global firms, so they want someone who can provide global capabilities. The second thing that we've done is we've moved from being focused on a single part of debt markets, which was originally high yield bonds, and gone into lots of different debt verticals. So we went to high yield bonds, to leverage loans, to distressed debt, private credit, ABF, CLOs in your world. And part of the reason for that is, one, there's client demand. Two, we need to expand our TAM to continue to scale and grow. But also, the clear lines between each of these debt silos is breaking down. And so part of our thesis is, if you're an Apollo or a Goldman Sachs or a KKR or, you know, a Kirkland Ellis, do you want to have five different vendors providing you what you need from a data, AI, workflows capability? Isn't it just easier to have a one-stop shop?
Yeah.
And so we now combine global coverage, pretty much all of debt asset classes, including investment grade now. We bought a business to help us there. And then also a rich suite of features so that you can get news flow, you can get financial data, you can get legal and covenant data all in one place. So that's, so the business today is a global business. We're about nearly 500 people across the world, growing 100% year over year. And then we just recently raised a big round of funding to help us, you know, go even faster.
Today you walk into Whole Foods, you go to the vegetable section, you go chicken section, the butcher, right? It's all under one roof. But there was a time when that model was crazy, right? You went to a different store over there, then you went to another place, right? Like, you spend the whole day kind of food shopping, right, and whatnot. So that evolution, I think, continues, and that, you know, that's what's happening now. And we see it as well that both on buy side and sell side, there's a lot more consolidation of roles. You see the same person on the buy side, to your point. You know, the trader who was just doing loans one time now does loans and bonds, loans and something else, right? So that certainly speaks to, I think, that parallel consolidation that is happening in the overall markets. You've been on this journey for some time now. If you look back to the kid at Bristol, you're coming out of college, what do you tell yourself?
So I think one of my learnings that I share with other entrepreneurs, and they always laugh, because I started the company very, very young, but everything takes longer than you expect.
Mm.
Everything's more difficult than you expect, and everything's more expensive than you expect. And so, you know, I think I wouldn't change any of the kind of wide-eyed optimism of let's go get it, but, you know, there's going to be plenty of challenges along the road.
Mm-hmm.
We build a complex product in a market that has demanding customers, and there are a lot of challenges along the way. It won't be smooth sailing. People might not always see them, but, you know, persevere and stick with it, you know, and scale as quickly as you can.
Yeah. When you look now how you set up the company, what's happening in the overall ecosystem. What do you think the industry looks like 3 years from now, 5 years from now? What's changed?
So I think AI is going to change a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a lot of time thinking about it when LLMs first came out. It's actually not even a new technology anymore. Yeah. It's several years old. But when they first came out, and we thought, is this more like crypto, where it's a solution kind of searching for a problem?
Yeah.
And okay, now crypto's doing fine, but you know, is it something like this where it's a bit of a hype and a fad? Or is this closer to the internet and yeah. mobile and e-commerce and something that's a step
and
change, or the internet or electricity?
Yeah.
And I think it is going to be a little bit closer to being like electricity or the internet. Mm-hmm. And I was at a conference the other day, and one of the speakers said something which really resonated with me, which was, he said, you know, when you walk into a room and you turn on the light switch, the idea of not having a light switch or electricity is just unfathomable. Like, you just couldn't think of what the world was like before it.
Yeah.
And so in 5 years' time, I think the idea will be that you'll have an AI agent doing a lot of your day-to-day work, and you'll be reviewing or organizing or doing the more relationship part of your job. And the idea of you yourself, like writing a credit memo or spreading the comps or doing a model in Excel, is going to kind of be like completely unfathomable for the analysts of that era. Like, well, why don't you have an AI agent doing it for you?
Yeah.
And so I think it will be a really big step change moment. I think some of our, you know, we come from an industry that's conservative, risk averse, slow to adopt new technologies, as you will know as well, in credit space. But even in credit markets, people realize this is a big change, both for the companies that they're investing in, but also for their own businesses. So I think the world will look very different. You know, 3 years ago, you had lots of engineers writing code. Today, engineers basically don't write code.
Yeah.
You have Cursor or Claude or, you know, OpenAI's Codex that writes the code for them and they review it. So I think people have to ask themselves, in 3 years' time, are you still going to be drafting a memo?
Yeah.
And people also get a bit nervous about, oh, does that mean it's going to come and take everyone's job, et cetera? But actually today there are more engineers being hired than there were 3 years ago. So I think it will be interesting how it evolves, but it's going to be a step change in how people do their work.
And I think it's a very good point, right? I agree with you completely that this is a seminal evolutionary moment. I use the example of the car. Believe it or not, there was a lot of controversy about cars, you know, and there's a story about the New York City Fire Department. They used to have horse-drawn fire engines. And one of the big debates at the time, controversy, was, oh, you can't have a car version of this thing, a truck version of this thing. How's it going to steer around the corner? It can steer as quickly as the horses. And that was the argument against it, right? And I'm sure it was also a very disruptive thing. There's a lot of industry around the horse.
Mm.
There is the haymaker, there's the horseshoe guy, you know, all those people who all of a sudden now have to rethink what they're going to do. And I think it's obviously what we as entrepreneurs should do, which is to help people see what's possible. What could the world look like when we have this new capability, right? You know, with cloud computing, now we can have apps, we can have Instagram, and then we can have influencers. I don't know if it's a good thing or bad thing, but that becomes possible because of the platform that we're creating. And I certainly hope that you guys can continue to pave the way and show what this new market should look like. We're not writing memos, but certainly, hopefully, we have a lot more issuance, right? Mm-hmm. And if there's more issuance, you know, hopefully it's cheaper for borrowers, right? And more people are coming into the space, and more investors are also coming into the space.
That's the thing. The market's maturing as well. And I think, you know, for a lot of the AI build out, you're going to need debt fund stuff. So like the most prolific issuers today are data centers.
Yeah.
Then you're going to need power behind the data centers. That's going to be a big growth sector. And, you know, there'll be some companies who will have AI challenges as well. So part of our business is helping our clients understand distressed companies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it will shake up the world.
Yeah.
But there's still going to be a lot of debt, and people are going to have to understand those investment opportunities. You know, managing people's pension and how it's allocated is not something that's going to be fully outsourced to a bot. It's going to have human supervision and intervention. But it will be a very different way that people do their jobs in the AI era in the future.
Steven, this has been an incredible conversation. I really appreciate you making the time and coming on the Ramp Up.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening today. For more conversations like these, subscribe to the Ramp Up wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you next time.